Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear Blood River Radio family, we've got an interesting thing here. We got Johan is staying on for one segment from South Africa because I know Rich did a fantastic job. He knows, I have no idea his knowledge was so in-depth about the intricacies of the politics in the continent of Africa and South Africa. He's going to be on for a segment as he's speaking. The bitter inner himself, I'm sure, will probably have some questions and like to talk to this man, Johan. What was your last name one time? One more time, Johan?
Achenbach.
Okay, Achenbach. Okay, and I'm sure, and we'll keep him on for a segment, and it's getting late over there anyway. So, and then we'll do our regular Confederate history, but I would like to also mention this. We tied the importance of the people, especially the young white people in South Africa, learning their true heritage. Our guest said that the young people over there are being taught to hate themselves being white. They should, even in the last segment, he said that even the churches, the largest churches, are saying that the white people should give the land back to the blacks. Hate yourself if you're white. I tell you what, if nobody knows better than Gene, the bitter ender, that the same things have been happening here in the United States ever since 1861 and before, and it's worse now than ever. And that's why we do Confederate history, because we want our young people, just like we need the young people in South Africa, to know about their South African history, their true white history, how great the white race was. We want our people here in the Confederacy, in the South, to know the same thing. And I consider the Confederate soldiers, the people of the Confederacy, the Afrikaners of the Battle of 1838, our German Waffen SS brothers, our German Wehrmacht brothers, we're all one and the same. With that, take it away, Johannes.
Oh, absolutely, sir. We do need to teach our children and our youth politics, history. But it is as Adolf Hitler once said, you know, we must do it in a way that brings the stories alive, not, you know, reduce it to just dates and regurgitation, but we need to make it alive for them. We need to tell the story of our people, because the more you know about and the more we learn about our history, the more I learn about our history as the Afrikaner people, they become greater and greater in my heart and in my mind, because these men, they did not achieve what they achieved by happenstance. It was an absolute, you know, testimony to their grit and their willpower and their faith. So we must teach our children these things.
Gene, tie that together. Oh, go ahead.
I got one more question I want to ask you before I bow out. Sure. There is a fascination on the right wing in here in England and over here in the United States with Orania. They seem to think that it's some kind of that's the model we need to strive for, and look how it's working out down there and blah 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 and all this kind of stuff. And I know the reality behind Orania, but I want you to tell the audience why Orania is not a good model.
Okay.
Yes,
well, great question.
I'm supposed to explain what the hell is Orania. So, but go ahead. That's a great question, Rich.
Sir, it's a good thing if you don't know what it is. It's better to be, you know, blissfully ignorant about it. But that's a great question, sir, about Orania. Yes, it gladdens me when people actually have got a grasp of what is happening here in this country. So Orania is funded in large part by AfriForum and Solidariteit. You could almost look at it like the State of Israel, right? Where the State of Israel is only viable because of all the money that it gets from the outside world, you know, in grants. And I believe the same thing for Orania. They don't have any industrial capacity, etc. And they can argue that they can get all these things. But the reality is everything that they say about Orania, like, see how it looks when white people do their own work. Well, we had that We had that when we had our own country. Look how it looks when white people run their own society. Well, we had that. Why must we now surrender what is ours just because blacks moved in here? Blacks are moving into Germany. Must the Germans then also surrender Bavaria because Bavaria's got, in the future, will have 40% blacks? Should they then say, okay, no, we're not going to have Bavaria anymore, you know, we'll move to a different province, and or we'll move to a little city because that's what we should abandon nationhood in pursuit of what is perceived to be peace. And it's on a strategic level, it's a little small town which in 30 years has only managed to have like what, 5,000 inhabitants, 3,000 inhabitants?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
So that's 30 years. Does that sound like a solution? So where are we going to be at in another 30 years? Are we going to be at 12,000? Our people are a big people. We can't be reduced to a city. It's sort of self-expropriation, if you think about it. If you give white people a solution that doesn't entail them having to fight for their future, which is not consistent with history in any way. So, no, I don't think Orania is a good thing because it is funded by organizations that are funded by Jews. As I understand, Jews are also allowed to live there in Orania because Orania explicitly says that they are not a whites-only town. They are an Afrikaner cultural town. So if you accept the Afrikaner culture, if you are a black man and you accept the Afrikaner culture, then you are welcome in Orania. This has been said by them on many occasions. So, you know, the very fact that they want to convince our people to surrender and concede South Africa to the blacks means that they are working for the exact same outcome that our racial enemies are. So I don't care if they say it is with good intent that they do that. The road to hell is paved in good intention. If we want the future, we must be willing to fight for it. If we want to be able to fight for it, we need to inspire our people and we need to rally our people behind an intent to do so. So, no, I am in any way conceivable against the idea of reducing our people to a political end goal such as Orania. And to further prove, make the point, Joost van Strydom from Orania said the other day to the French, there's no shame in leaving your country behind. Once we were French and we left France to come to South Africa, so they shouldn't be ashamed to leave France. The French people, with all their thousands of years of history, shouldn't be ashamed to leave their country. They should consider the Orania option. They should consider the Orania model. Now, which is exactly what the Jews want us to do. They want this globalist state in which nationalism is utterly defeated. There are no borders. And we are ultimately just a bunch of consumers. And Orania and all of these little projects that they've got around the world are nothing other than glorified museums where they turn our people into a recreational museum. So no, I am against it. I'll always be against it. I stand for the freedom of the white man, the freedom of the Afrikaner people, and the reclaiming of what is rightfully given, what was rightfully given to us by God. This is something that every Afrikaner feels in his heart, but they don't yet have the courage to say it because they feel intimidated, because there is legitimate persecution for white people that want their own countries. Because the Jews are occupying all seats of power in our governments. Why does no single white nation have institutional power that communicates white destiny? Why is that?
It's always Jews all the time. Just like Dave Gaharie once said, it's always Jews all the time. That's what I was saying earlier. What if it's Julius Malina instead of saying, kill the Boer, what if he said, kill the Jew? I guarantee you would have the United States Air Force in there. You'd have the Army. You know, I mean, that would never – I know it was a rhetorical question, but if he started naming the enemy, naming the Jew there would be no more Julius Malema.
You want to hear something interesting, sir?
The solution is name the Jew and get rid of the damn Jew. But go ahead, give me this. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Something interesting is Julius Malema said he is not an anti-Semite because the EFF, as its biggest allies are and biggest funders are Jews. So he doesn't want blacks to be anti-Semitic. You know,
wow, what a shocker, man.
sort of like Jared Taylor.
No, I see so many similarities, and I know Gene can take up on this, and I hope we didn't take up too much of his time, but it's Confederate history, South African history, German history. It's over all tied together because we're all white Europeans. We all came from Europe at one time. And the same enemy, the sons of their father, the devil, the Africa Corps, the Jews, the Satan's officer corps, the Jews, is our enemy. It's that similar drive. Well, anyway, thank you so much, Joanne, for coming out. And I'll be contacting you. You contact me. You know, we had transitioned to this next segment. We'll bring in the Bitter Ender with Confederate history and let Bitter Ender tie up what he just said, what we just said on this segment. Be right back, folks.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
This is Attorney Jason Ruff, General Counsel of the Knights Party based out of Harrison, Arkansas, and proud supporter of Blood River Radio. I, like you, am concerned about the destruction of our beloved America and our racial kindred people and our cherished liberties. As an individual, and as a nation, liberty is what we seek. Liberty is important. It is what allows us to be independent. And if properly used, liberty allows us to fully worship God in all areas of life. And with that worship comes more liberty. We are on the verge of anarchy in this country. And personal liberty is looked upon as a crowning achievement of the people. However, Christianity and white law and order is viewed as the enemy of this new found freedom. And that is why it is under attack. Learn more while listening to Blood River Radio every Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m.
Former Sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at cspoa.org. That's cspoa.org.
Blood River Radio family, what an amazing, amazing broadcast. You know, and one thing I love having Rich and Gene on together. We three, just like we said on the air a minute ago, we were on commercial, but we rode to Charlottesville together. And I knew them before that, but we really bonded. It was me, Gene, the Bitter Ender, Rich and Gene. And Matt Goodwin and Simon Roach, we rode up there and back together. And I tell you what, as long as I have my mind together, guys, I'll never, ever forget that. I love y'all so much, I know. And I'm a sentimental old son of a bitch. I really am. You know, I get attached to people. I can't let them go. But anyway, I know that Gene, the Bitter Ender, I know he can tie together everything we talked about on the first, second hour with what's going on in South Africa, what's going on here in the southern, especially in the southern United States, what's been going on since 1861. The Bitter Ender is to Confederate history with these other guys were the South African history. But if you will, Gene, break that down, what little bit you heard, compare, contrast, tie together what's going on in South Africa, the enemy over there. We all know who the enemy is. The enemy trying to beat the life out of the white people over there, teach them that they're nothing but a bunch of scum, that hate themselves. Same thing happened here, but deck off, Gene. Go off on that, brother, if you will. Then we hit Confederate history. I'm sorry. I hope I didn't take up too much of your time.
No. That's fine, Eddie. That's fine. We got a great tie-in here. Well, that is exactly what's happening here. And I heard some people talking about an earlier period in history with Rhodesia. And the first thing they did in Rhodesia was to destroy the monuments and tear their history down. And then they went after taking the farms away and the businesses away from whites and turning it over to these feral black animals who slaughtered all the livestock and ate it. And then they couldn't figure out why there weren't any calves being born the next year. And then they ate up all the crops, and they had no seed to plant for the next year. And they couldn't figure out why they were starving. And now all these liberal bleeding heart organizations have to, oh, we have to take care of the poor starving blacks in South Africa or in what do they call Rhodesia now? Forgotten whatever African name they gave it. Unlivable hellhole, whatever that translates into in Swahili.
Zimbabwe?
Yeah, there you go. It's just like what they're doing here. The first thing they did was to destroy the monuments and tear our history down. And then if you don't have anybody to look up to, then these communists, these perverts, and the Jews come in and say, well, now it was all bad. We got rid of all the bad stuff. Now we're going to teach you what all the good stuff is. And so that's an old scheme that they've used in hundreds of countries all over the globe. And it never works. It makes things worse. I mean, look at what the Russian Revolution did in 1917. You know, communism was supposed to be so great and everybody was going to be equal. And it brought one dictatorship after another in on the Russian people and turned it. The World War II was not a war to save democracy. It was a war to save communism. And it just, you know, spread through Eastern Europe and all over the world. And these people are just, they're evil. They're evil. They're evil psychos. And really, it's horrible what they do to these countries and what they've done to South Africa. And I don't know if you all brought this up. South Africa used to be the richest country on the continent of Africa. And I've always said at one time they had the first heart transplant in South Africa. That's how advanced it was. Dr. Christian Barnard did the first heart transplant anywhere in the world at a hospital in South Africa. And then they also used to have the first F1, Formula One race, Grand Prix.
Wow.
Every year it was the first race because when it's winter up here, it's summer down there on the southern hemisphere. And so you did not get an F1, Formula One race with Bernie Ecclestone promoting the thing without a ton of money put up front. So that's how rich South Africa used to be. And, of course, they turned it over to that African National Congress, which is a communist organization, and they just destroyed the country, and they've destroyed Rhodesia. So and Eddie, you know this. Look where they've taken over in inner-city Memphis or Nashville or Chicago, Detroit. The same thing happens everywhere. It's like a plague of locusts coming in and just sweeping through there and destroying everything in sight. So, you know, I feel for the Afrikaners. I really do. They're trapped there. And you know, I don't know how they're going to be able to get out of there or change anything there. I think Trump was trying to get some of them special visas to get out and come to the States. I know Russia is taking in a lot of the farmers from South Africa. Quite a different climate in the wintertime up there in Russia. But anyway, at least they can get away from the feral black animals in South Africa. Won't be just killed and slaughtered and have their throats cut in their own bedroom. So hopefully enough of them can get out and get away from that place. But it's the whole country just collapsed. They've turned it over to a bunch of incompetence and greed and corruption, and that's the order of the day. It's like any country any country, any city, any county that these black communists take over, it's a disaster. So with that being said, we have a tie-in today on our Confederate history.
Yes.
You asked me last week. We got down to the end of the hour, and we were talking about what was left of the Confederate Navy, and there were a few ships left in the James River Squadron, and a Confederate admiral, Admiral Raphael Sims, was put in command of the last of the Confederate Navy, And when Richmond was evacuated and the lines that were broken at Petersburg and Lee's army started heading west out of Richmond, Admiral Sims sank these ships in the James River because he didn't want the enemy Navy, the Federal Navy, to be the first enemy to come into Richmond. And so you said it might be a good idea to tell our listeners a little bit about the history of Admiral Raphael Sims in the Confederate States Navy. And it's really a very interesting biography. He was actually born in Maryland in 1809. He entered the U.S. Navy, became a midshipman in 1826, rose to the rank of lieutenant in 1837, and got the rank of commander in 1855. Now, this was in the U.S. Navy. He studied law at the same time and wrote a really interesting book. If you ever get a chance to read it, it's called Memoirs of Service Afloat, and he wrote it after the war. And it tells you about how they sailed ships back then and what you had to know about setting the sails to catch the wind. It's like a travel log, because when he became captain of the Confederate commerce raider, the Alabama, they sailed all over the world. And all these ports he talked about in the Caribbean and the North Atlantic, South Atlantic, Indian Ocean. And the point being, the Alabama, the Confederate commerce raider, stopped at Cape Town, South Africa. And they were getting water and supplies there. And they were hailed as heroes by the Afrikaners, because they were fighting against an imperial empire of the United States, like the Afrikaners had to fight against the British coming in and taking their land away from the Dutch settlers. So there were a lot of tie-ins there. So Captain Sims served in the Mexican War for the U.S. Navy and served in the blockade of Veracruz during the Mexican War. Then after that, he settled in Mobile, Alabama. Like I said, he had studied law and became a lawyer after the war, or during the war, but then practiced after the war. And the reason being, I mentioned that in the first couple of chapters of that book, Memoirs of Service Afloat, he lays out in very succinct and very understandable legal terms about why secession was legal. And the South had every legal right to leave the Union. And he points out to several things in the Constitution, several law cases and so forth like that. So he lays it out for any of the readers, not just the naval history, but the reason why the South leaving the Union was a legal act. And of course, Lincoln said it wasn't, and refused to recognize the Confederate States of America. But Admiral Sims tells you exactly why it was. So anyway, he settled in Mobile, Alabama. When Alabama left the Union, he volunteered his services to the Confederate States of America. Before the war started, he actually went north to New York City and purchased naval supplies. And New York was very, very pro-Southern. Governor Seymour actually...
I didn't know that.
Oh, they were. And Governor Seymour of New York, after the Lincoln dictatorship got to be as bad as it was, Governor Seymour of New York wanted New York to secede from the Union, not to join the Confederacy, but just to get away from Lincoln and not have anything to do with it, just be its own country until Lincoln was out of office or whatever happened. But, of course, they clamped down on him and anybody in New York that was even talking about secession. They were thrown in jail. Newspapers were destroyed. The press is broken up. The editors thrown in jail. This is how the Lincoln democracy worked. It was a dictatorship. So anyway, the Confederate States of America had no Navy. They had to outfit ships to attack what, so the plan they came up with was to outfit these ships. And this was Stephen Mallory, the secretary of the Confederate Navy, and Admiral Sims together. Well, he wasn't an admiral then, but Captain Sims together came up with this idea to outfit ships and send them out on the high seas all over the world to attack U.S. merchant ships. Now, the Confederacy didn't have the naval power to fight all the warships and break the blockade, but they could go after merchant ships. So that was the idea of what they were going to do. And we'll explain how they did that and the success they had with that once we get right back from our break.
That sounds like the Wolfpack.
Protecting your liberties. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Jason Walker. That death toll expected to continue climbing in Myanmar. It's currently at 1,644 confirmed dead now. Foreign correspondent Charles de Ledesma.
The 7.7 magnitude earthquake, which rocked Myanmar and neighboring Thailand, has killed at least three people in Bangkok, burying dozens when a high-rise building under construction collapsed. In an AP interview, this American, who's lived in Bangkok for 28 years, was on the phone when the quake hit.
I was in my Lazy Boy, and all of a sudden it moved back and forth, and then it toppled over, and I hit my head on the table.
I'm Charles de Ledesma.
More than 3,500 people have been injured, some of them critically, and officials do say that hundreds more are missing in rubble and feared dead. In South Texas, very heavy rains this week and flooding, claiming the lives of at least four people. Dozens of homes have been destroyed or badly damaged. Also, at townhall.com, Department of Veterans Affairs Secretary Doug Collins will be coming before the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee for the first time since taking office. He'll answer questions about the agency's plans to further reduce its workforce amid a hiring freeze and the cancellation of hundreds of contracts with community agencies. A federal judge has ruled more than 109,000 square miles of Gulf Coast were unlawfully opened up for offshore drilling leases. The judge says the Department of Interior did not account for the offshore drilling leases' impacts on, quote, greenhouse gas emissions. Environmental groups, the federal government, and the oil and gas industry now discussing remedies. More on these stories at townhall.com.
Let's face it, the world is uncertain these days, but there's something reassuring about holding on to what lasts. The 2025 1-ounce Gold Eagle from the U.S. Mint, a symbol of American strength and an asset that stands the test of time. You can trust gold and you can trust Global Coin. Call 833-SPOT-GOLD to secure this magnificent coin graded in pristine MS-70 condition for the dealer cost of $30.99. Free shipping, no sales tax. This is your chance to own a piece of history while building a foundation of enduring value. It gets even better. Global Coin is giving the first 100 callers a free MS-70 2025 Silver Eagle to complement your 1-ounce Gold Eagle. Two iconic coins, a symbol of prosperity and a testament to the enduring value of gold and silver. Global Coin backs every purchase with a 30-day return policy, ensuring your peace of mind. Visit globalcoindeal.com or call 833-SPOT-GOLD. No gimmicks, incredible coins at incredible prices. Again, that's 833-SPOT-GOLD.
During our war for Southern independence, the brilliant Confederate general Robert E. Lee foretold the decline of this country when he prophesied, if those people, referring to the dictatorial federal government, if those people win this war, the United States will become a bully abroad and a tyrant at home. As Lee predicted, it has come to pass. The principles laid out in our founding documents, our Declaration of Independence, and the individual rights protected in our Constitution have been vilified and discarded. But not everyone has surrendered. Blood River Radio brings you highly respected, intelligent guests not afraid to speak the truth when the truth in America today is censored and attacked. Your contributions keep us on the air in order to fight against the bullies abroad and the tyrants at home. Send your war contributions to Blood River Radio, P.O. Box 34636, Bartlett, Tennessee 38184. That address is on our website, www.bloodriverradio.com. Don't let the bullies and the tyrants win.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an Immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
In the medical field, IT security is crucial. Our highly skilled consultants are HIPAA certified and have 20 plus years of experience servicing medical clinics, billing and supply companies. We offer comprehensive endpoint protection, guarding your computers and servers against all stages of threats. And with our 24/7 monitoring services, you'll never worry about extensive downtime again. Ready to level up your IT support? Call 801-706-6980 today and discover how great IT services can be with Managed IT Services.
Being this is a 44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
Oh, Blood River Radio family. We're not going to waste any more time. I'm starting to get tongue-tied. I guess I've been so excited here for going on 3 hours now. But we're going to go right back to the Bitter Ender. We had an amazing idea, at least, I'm sure the Bitter Ender had already thought about it, but we talked about the wolf packs and how it kind of resembled the Confederate raiders, et cetera, et cetera. But go ahead, Bitter Ender.
Yes, sir. Stephen Mallory, Secretary of the Confederate Navy, knew that they couldn't match the U.S. Navy ship for ship. So they started building these ironclads. We talked about last week the battle between the Virginia and the Monitor and these ironclad ships that they built to defend the southern ports and keep the ports open for blockade runners, because they had to have these forts at the entrance to the harbor, and then they would have these ironclads that would go out and attack the federal blockade squadron to keep the ports open so the blockade runners could bring back the supplies from England, haul the cotton out of the south, trade it with the English for war materials, medicine, and things like that that Lincoln clamped an embargo on, wouldn't allow any medicine to come into the South. So anyway, the other plan that they had was to outfit these modern ships, these cruisers, as warships and prey not on the Federal Navy but on the U.S. Merchant Marine. And the idea being that if they crippled the Yankee economy to the point Lincoln might grant us our independence, or at least pull some of the ships off the blockade to try to hunt down all these ships that the Confederates had sailing all over the seven seas, literally all over the globe, hunting down anything that was flying a U.S. flag. And it was extremely successful. By 1864, no foreign country would ship a cargo on a U.S. ship. They could not get insurance for the cargo because ships like Captain Sims and the Alabama, the Shenandoah, the Nashville, the Florida, the Tallahassee, all these commerce raiders were out there looking for anything with a U.S. flag on it. So back to our biography of the day of Raphael Sims. The first ship he commanded was the CSS Sumter, and it was a converted cruiser that was armed as a warship in the city of New Orleans. And then it slipped down the Mississippi River and waited at one of the passes. You know, the Mississippi splits out into several channels or passes out into the Gulf of Mexico. And so they were waiting to find a night where they could slip out of one of these passes and get past the blockade squadron out in the Gulf there that was trying to shut down the port of New Orleans. So they made a successful escape. And in just a little over 6 months, Captain Sims and the Sumter captured 17 U.S. ships, and they would have to burn the ship because, they couldn't take it back to a Confederate port because of the blockade squadron, and they couldn't take it into a neutral port in Spain or Italy or England or anywhere like that and sell it because the U.S. government wouldn't allow them to do that. They would come down on the British or the French or whoever like a ton of bricks and would disavow that sale. So the only thing left to do, any sailor hates to see another ship go down. They would have to just burn the ship. They'd take the crew off, take off whatever cargo they needed, water, that sort of thing, any navigable naval equipment that they needed, and take the passengers or the crew off and then burn the ship. And after they captured two or three ships, they had so many passengers on deck, they would have to either pull into a neutral port and unload them, or if they had burned four ships, the fifth one, they would put all the civilians on that fifth ship and let them go after they signed a promissory note that if they didn't burn their ship, they would pay the Confederate government X amount of money for the value of the ship. And, of course, when they sailed off, the crews on the Confederate cruisers just laughed and said, yeah, we'll never see that money. The Yankee government wasn't about to pay that. But they had to get rid of all the civilians they had on deck. So the Sumter was the first ship that Captain Sim commanded. And after a while, it was an old ship, and it pretty much got worn out. He brought it into Gibraltar and sold it to the British. And then while he was in England, James Bullock and Matthew Fontaine Murray were working for the Confederate government in England, and they were buying, with Confederate cotton coming into England, they were buying these state-of-the-art sailing ships. And they were three-masted sailing ships, but they also had steam engines, which was really an advancement for that time. If there wasn't any wind, they could use the steam power and turn the prop and get it going, or if they had to negotiate their way into a real dangerous channel coming into a port, they could use the steam engine for that. The ship that Admiral Sims got was, they had, I think, a number 61, where it's built in the Laird shipyards in Liverpool. And then once they took it out away from British waters, the British were supposed to be neutral, and they weren't supposed to build warships for either side, north or south, but everybody knew what they were going to do with it. So the United States consulate in England was griping and whining about this ship being built, and so they had to take it. They were going to take it out for a test run, and so once they got outside of British waters, they said, the test is over. It's our ship. We're gone. And they took it down to the Azores and met another Confederate ship and armed it with these heavy naval guns and rechristened it. It wasn't a ship number 61 in the Laird shipyards. It was the CSS Alabama. And over the next 22 months from, from August of 1862 to June of 1864, the Alabama took 69 ships as prizes and destroyed most of them. And like I said, about the third or fourth one, they had to turn them loose with the crew and all the civilians on them to get them off the decks of the Alabama. And they complained about it and said that, well, these were just pirates out there attacking merchant ships. And the Confederate reply was, well, you're burning warehouses and railroad depots and private homes in the South. What's the difference? You're doing it on land. We're taking these ships out on the high seas. And why are you complaining about us being pirates when what you're doing to the South is far worse? So anyway, like I said, they traveled all over the world, and they did come into Cape Town, South Africa. They lost one of their officers there. They were out hunting on a lake in South Africa just to get some fresh duck meat or whatever. Hmm. And they brought this little boat over to the shore, and this officer handed the butt of a rifle to somebody on the shore, and the fella grabbed the trigger, and it went off and shot him and killed him. And he was buried in South Africa. And after apartheid ended in South Africa, they were able to get that body and bring it back to the United States. And he is now buried at the Sons of Confederate Veterans headquarters in Columbia, Tennessee. Has a grave there for this officer from the CSS Alabama. And they even had a song in South Africa that school children used to sing called Here Comes the Alabama. And they were great heroes to the people in South Africa. So it wasn't just the Alabama. That we said that the Florida, the Nashville, the Tallahassee. Now, the Tallahassee sailed out of Wilmington, North Carolina. And in a little over 2 months, they took 38 ships between New York City and Halifax, Nova Scotia, because that was one of the major sea lanes. And they were even headed for the Brooklyn Navy Yard. They were going to attack the Brooklyn Navy Yard, but they were running low on coal, and they didn't want to get trapped inside the Verrazano Narrows coming into the harbor there at New York, and then went on back to Wilmington. Another one was the Florida. Captain Maffitt commanded that. And they went into a neutral port in Brazil for repairs, and a U.S. warship came into that port and deliberately rammed the Florida and damaged it so severely that it couldn't be used as a warship anymore. And so they threatened to arrest the crew, and the Brazilian government was going crazy. He said, you can't do that. This is a neutral country. And the typical U.S., they just ignored them, said, okay, you want to go to war with the United States? Well, no, I don't guess we can do that. Okay. So they took the ship, took the Florida in tow, brought it back to the United States, and then it mysteriously sank in the Chesapeake Bay. So that's how upstanding the United States rotten government in Washington is. Another one that was famous was the Shenandoah, and it was commanded by James Waddell. Same thing. It was bought from the British, taken outside British waters, armed as a Confederate cruiser or warship, and then it sailed down the Atlantic, rounded the Cape there, across the Indian Ocean, took ships there, picked up a detachment of Confederate Marines in Melbourne, Australia. Well, they were Aussies, God. But they became Confederate Marines, sailed up across the Pacific and attacked the U.S. whaling fleet in the Bering Sea. And we'll finish this up on our final segment.
Golly Moses, that's so interesting. They just did an incredible amount of sailing. We'll be right back, folks.
Step into the boots of the American West with Range Magazine, where grit meets grace. This is a front row seat to the stories, struggles, and triumphs of ranchers, farmers, and stewards of the land. From jaw-dropping photography to no-nonsense reporting, Range brings you the untold tales of life on the range. Whether you're a city dweller with a cowboy's heart or living life where the pavement ends, Range speaks to the soul of the West. Subscribe today at rangemagazine.com.
This is Michael Hill, Chief of the League of the South. I listen to Blood River Radio, and you should too. In fact, you should be telling your friends, your family, and your associates to listen to Eddie Miller and the good folks at Blood River Radio. They stand resolutely for the preservation of white civilization, what we once called Christendom, and they stand against the ongoing campaign of white genocide. In these trying and uncertain times, it's more important than ever to speak and act in defense of our God, our people, and our civilization. Blood River Radio speaks the truth and speaks it boldly. I've been on this show many times as a guest, and I'm very proud of my association with you. May our just cause prevail. Hail victory.
This is a battle. A battle between truth and deceit. A battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by 6 corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpochTimes.com.
Dear Blood River Radio family, I got to make this really, really quick. I had no idea. I didn't have a clue how much damage that this tiny Confederate Navy had inflicted upon the United States Merchant Marine. Gene, a bitter ender, tell the people briefly, I don't want to interrupt you, but just what did the few Confederate raiders have? What did they do to the United States Merchant Marine?
They destroyed it because nobody in a foreign country, well, not the United States businesses, would ship a cargo on a U.S. ship because they knew these raiders were out there looking for anything with the U.S. flag. So these ships just rotted in port, or they would have to have their ownership transferred to a foreign country, to Britain, Portugal, Italy, you know, whoever. So it took over 100 years for the U.S. Merchant fleets to recover from that.
God!
Now, in June of 1864, the Alabama limped into Cherbourg, France. It had been out on the high seas for 2 years. And when that's going on, all that copper plating on the hull that they have on a ship to cover up the wood, to keep barnacles and things from eating right through the wood and destroying the ship. A lot of that copper plating had been bent back, had come off. The steam engines were worn out. A lot of the sails were ripped and torn. They hadn't been in a port for over 2 years for any time. They couldn't come back to the south because of the blockade and all the warships looking for them around the U.S. So they would try to pull in somewhere and get coal, food, fresh water, whatever they could. And then if the U.S. consulate there found out that there was a Confederate ship in the port, they would threaten for an economic boycott of the island in the Caribbean or in the South Atlantic or the Indian Ocean, wherever they were. So they would have to leave after they got just barely what they needed. So in June of 64, the Alabama, like we said, kind of limped into Cherbourg, France for repairs. The Alabama, being in Cherbourg, was reported to the consulate in England, and the U.S. Navy sent down to Cherbourg the USS Corsage, which was an actual warship. It was not a converted cruiser. It had all the heavy guns on it. The French, with the mighty backbone that they have, told the Alabama they were going to have to leave port. They couldn't stay there. And all of a sudden, the word spread that there was going to be a battle between two American ships outside the three-mile limit, out of French waters, out in basically in the English Channel. And that Sunday, there were special trains that were run from Paris down to Cherbourg with packed full of people that were coming down there to watch this naval battle. And the crew on the Alabama, some of them said that when they left the harbor, they looked back and all the hills along the ocean front there, the, up above the beaches, it was just black with people from the dark, you know, clothes and everything on, packed with people watching this battle. Oh, one thing about the Alabama. I've seen a picture of the crew, and I used that on one of my programs. One of the officers, now the Alabama did not have a Marine detachment on board. That was the Shenandoah and some of the other ones. But they did have an officer, a Marine officer, Howell, and he was a brother-in-law of Jefferson Davis. His sister was Verena Howell Davis, the wife of President Jefferson Davis. So they did have an officer that had a relationship to President Davis through his wife. So anyway, that morning, June 19th, the Alabama weighed anchor and headed out of Cherbourg out into the English Channel to take on this Yankee warship. What they did, they would sail in these giant circles, firing at each other and moving from east to west, but in a giant circle, in concentric circles. An early shot from the Alabama hit and lodged in between the hull and the rudder of the Corsage. Had it blown up, it would have blown the whole ass into that ship off, and no rudder, no, you know, water pouring into the hull. But the primer in the charge and the percussion caps, the Alabama had been out so long on the ocean that it had corroded and gotten bad, and that hull, that huge 130-pound shell was lodged in between the rudder and the hull, and I know they were looking over the side being nervous about, is this thing going to blow up here? Did blow up. But it's in a museum somewhere. I've read that they have that. So anyway, after about an hour's battle, the Corsage had, well, before it started, they had draped chains over the side of the ship to protect their wooden hull. And the Alabama couldn't figure out why a lot of their shots were hitting the Corsage but bouncing off. The Alabama was finally defeated after a one-hour battle. 19 of the crew were killed. The ship was going down, and the Yankees, in their typical fashion, kept firing on the Alabama and hitting the lifeboats and anybody that was left on deck to try to finish them off or, you know, send them down and let them drown. They wouldn't send a boat over to pick up the survivors. But there was an English yacht, the Deerhound, and this fella had brought his family down there to watch this battle on his yacht from England. And he came in and picked up a lot of the crew of the Alabama out of the water and got Admiral Sims out and put them on his ship, and they went back to England. And, of course, the U.S. government was griping about why the English took this pirate out of the water, and they demanded he turn them over and said, no, we're a neutral country. We're not doing that. One other story about the Alabama, the ship's doctor, Dr. Llewellyn, they were loading all these wounded in one of the boats that the Yankees hadn't shot to pieces, and they said, doctor, you can go with them. The doctor always goes with the wounded. And he said, no, if I get in, that boat's going to capsize. And one more person in there is going to make this boat. I mean, it was so down so low in the water was about coming over the sides of the rowboat anyway. So he said, no, push him off. Get him out of here. I can't get in there. What he didn't tell him was he couldn't swim. So when the Alabama went down, he went down with it. So that was the type of individuals that we had. So anyway, the Alabama was sunk. Admiral Sims, through blockade runners, actually got back to take his next command in Richmond. And he had to take a blockade runner, and he returned to the Confederacy through Matamoros, Mexico. He got on a homemade raft and rowed it across the Mississippi River and finally got back to Richmond. There he was promoted to admiral. In February of 1865, he was given the James River Squadron, which was two ironclads and three wooden cruisers. And like we said before, he sunk those in the James River after Richmond was evacuated to keep the U.S. Navy out of Richmond. And they were not the first enemy to come into Richmond. It was the Army that did that. Then he left Richmond with a bunch of sailors and Marines. And when he went south of Richmond and toward Danville and was trying to get back to join Lee's army that was going west, and they were going west, but Admiral Sims and his crew and some of the soldiers, but the sailors and Marines were further south. Every time they tried to turn back north, they found that the Yankee army was between them and General Lee's army. And finally, he heard that Lee had surrendered at Appomattox, so they turned south, left Virginia, and went down to North Carolina. Joseph E. Johnston and what is left of the Army of Tennessee were fighting Sherman, had fought Sherman through South Carolina and up into North Carolina, and Admiral Sims wound up surrendering with the Army of Tennessee at Durham Station. He was arrested. They were going to charge him as being a pirate. He was imprisoned at the Marine Barracks at 8th and I Street in Washington, and they thought the Marines were just going to treat him like some kind of horrible criminal, lock him in a dungeon. What they didn't know was the commandant of the Marine Corps at that time was Jacob Zeilin. And Jacob Zeilin and Admiral Sims had served in the U.S. Navy before the war. And yes, he was a prisoner at the Marine Barracks, but he lived in the commandant's home there. And he had his own bedroom upstairs and come down every morning. He'd have breakfast with Jacob Zeilin and said, hey, you remember that time we were in Singapore? Oh, yeah, I remember that time. Don't tell Mrs. Zeilin about that, but yeah, I remember that time. So they had a great time together. And when Stanton, the head of the War Department, found out about it, he was furious that he was living it up as a prisoner. Went back to Alabama, practiced law after the war, and died in 1877. There was a statue of Admiral Raphael Sims in Mobile. I doubt that it's there anymore. They've cleared out all of our statues all over the country. But I've seen that statue there, and in fact had a picture of it. We had a Sons of Confederate Veterans National Convention in Mobile one time, and I definitely wanted to see the Raphael Sims statue and where he's buried, and took a picture of it. But I'm sure with ethnic cleansing like they've done all over, and like what we all were talking about earlier, about what they've done to the people of South Africa and painted the Afrikaners as being these horrible villains, then that's what they've done to our history here. So I hope our listeners got a little bit of information about some Confederate history. Very little is known about the Confederate Navy.
I didn't know hardly anything, Gene.
Yeah. So hope they enjoyed it. It's been a pleasure to be on the program, as always. And thank you for the opportunity, Eddie. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for being an absolute pillar, an absolutely vital part of Blood Drip Radio and being my brother. God bless you. See you same time, same place next week. It'll be the day before my birthday. Sunday, next Sunday will be my birthday, man. Maybe you can sing Dixie for me.
We'll get something for you.
Yes, sir. God bless you. Thank you so much, Peter Ender. Thank you so much, Miss Teenage America. Thank you, all you Blood Group Radio family members who's listening and keeping us on the air. God bless you. See you same time, same place next Saturday, April the 5th, the day before my birthday. Good night, everybody.